content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today I'll be reading from the archives of the New Yorker magazine. First, we'll complete the story we started last week about the life and writings of a great young American author whose life ended tragically in suicide at the age of 46, David Foster Wallace. That's from the March 9th, 2009 edition of the New Yorker magazine. And if we have time, we'll finish that with a story entitled Where Millennials Come from the 2017 edition of the New Yorker magazine. So, to begin with, part two of The Unfinished, David Foster Wallace's Struggle to Surpass Infinite Jest by T.D. Maxx. Originally published in the March 9th, 2009 edition of the New Yorker magazine. We left off, it was 1990. David Foster Wallace was a graduate student at Harvard. He had published his first book, The Broom of the System, in 1987 that garnered national attention and critical praise. Unfortunately, he struggles with depression, and he went into a psychiatric hospital, and now we begin with him at the halfway house. At the halfway house, Wallace got to know people with radically different backgrounds. Mr. Howard, he wrote to his editor, everyone here has a tattoo or a criminal record or both. The halfway house also showed him that less intellectual people were often better at dealing with life. They found catchphrases such as, one day at a time, genuinely helpful. To his surprise, so did he. As he later told Salon, the idea that something so simple and really so aesthetically uninteresting, which for me meant you pass over it for the interesting complex stuff, can actually be nourishing in a way that arch, meta, ironic, pomo stuff can't. That seems to me to be important. Wallace picked up stories at treatment sessions, including his own. Former addicts love to talk. Part of their therapy was to talk. Eventually, Wallace was released to a quarterway house and then to a house with one other ex-addict. Wallace taught at Emerson College for a time. I've had to educate myself about people like Stephen Crane and Edith Wharton. He wrote Franson in October 1991. Actually, that's been a blast. I had no idea they were so good. I remember reading them a little in high school and mostly wondering when they would get done so I could go eat something sugary and then masturbate. He added that the last patina of rebelliousness has fallen off. By then, he had started working on, quote, The Project, his name for his second novel. In March 1991, he informed Nadell that he was now writing daily on a schedule. Roughly a year later, he promised her that he was, quote, going to shoot for having at least 100 pages, roughly probably a sixth or seventh, of this long document in your hands by April, end quote. When the pages were ready, he wanted them to go to Gerald Howard with the voluminous notes of explanation and defense I'll doubtless enclose. He was still interested in the warping power of media culture, and he had a new appreciation of addiction and its lethality. It gave him something to warn against. He created a character named Hal Incandenza, who bridged two worlds Wallace knew well. Incandenza is a pothead and a talented high school tennis player. He goes to an academy run by his family, which his older brother Oren also attended. Their father, James, a filmmaker, committed suicide after making a short movie called Infinite Jest, recorded in a format called a cartridge, which is so engrossing that anyone who watches it loses all desires. Wallace writes of one viewer, he has rewound to the beginning several times and then configured for a recursive loop. He sits there, attached to a congealed supper, watching it, oh, 2,000 hours, having now wet both his pants and his special recliner. The action is set in the near future. A Quebecois separatist group tries to get hold of Infinite Jest, copies of which are extremely rare, to use as a terrorist weapon. Wallace worked quickly in the house that he shared. He filled page after page of grade school notebooks and then typed what he'd written with two fingers on an old computer. In a letter to Nadell, he had made a promise. I will be a fiction writer again or die trying. In June 1992, Wallace set out for Syracuse. The rents were cheap, and Wallace wanted to put the traumas of Boston behind him. He found a room to work in opposite the food co-op. It was so small, he told friends, that his own body heat would keep it warm enough. He returned to the project. The writing continued to go well, and he stayed focused. Around town, Wallace was a familiar sight in his T-shirt, granny glasses, shorts, and bandana. He told Rolling Stone that he wore it to keep his head from exploding. The poet Mary Carr, who taught at Syracuse and dated Wallace, recalls him filling his five-and-dime notebooks with, quote, that fastidious little spider hand, end quote. He was working well. He would make sure to use the same pen the next day. He called it his orgasm pen. Costella, who visited him at Syracuse, recalls, he would walk around with a notebook, sit down, cross his legs, and start writing. Desperate as his life was, he was working. By May 1992, he had sent 200 pages of Infinite Jest to Howard, who read them with amazement. He now saw Wallace's addiction, dissent, and recovery as a ceremony of purification. Michael Peach, an editor at Little Brown and who had become friends with Wallace, also read the pages. I want to do this book more than I want to breathe, he told Bonnie Nadell. Peach, who had a reputation for publishing innovative fiction, outbid Howard with an $80,000 offer and Wallace changed publishers. Wallace was pushing himself to get beyond the facile skepticism of Broom. In 1993, he told Whiskey Island, a literary magazine, this is a generation that has an inheritance of absolutely nothing as far as meaningful moral values, and it's our job to make them up. He detected a pervasive sadness in the country. It manifests itself as a kind of lostness, he told Salon in an interview after the book was published. Infinite Jest is a story of people in pain. Near the book's opening, Hal Incandenza is rushed to an emergency room in the midst of a breakdown. The book reads, it will start in the ER, at the intake desk, or in the green-tiled room after the room with the invasive digital machines, or, given this special MD-supplied ambulance, maybe on the ride itself. Some blue-jawed MD scrubbed to an antiseptic glow with his name sewn in cursive on his white coat's breast pocket and a quality desk-set pen. Wanting gurney-side Q&A, etiology, and diagnosis by Socratic method, ordered and point by point. There are, by the OED, six counts, 19 non-archaic synonyms for unresponsive, of which nine are Latinate and four saxonic. It will be someone blue-collar and unlicensed, though, inevitably. A nurse's aide with quick-bit nails, a hospital security guy, a tired Cuban orderly who addresses me as Zhao, who will, looking down in the middle of some kind of bustled task, catch what he sees as my eye and say, and ask, so yo then, man, what's your story? The passage held out our hope rare signaled in his earlier work, the possibility that telling a story could lead to redemption. The idea had been central to the sobriety sessions he had attended. As he told Salon, I get the feeling that a lot of us, privileged Americans, as we enter our early 30s, have to find a way to put childish things and confront stuff about spirituality and values. Probably the AA model isn't the only way to do it, but it seems to be one of the more vigorous. His relationship with Mary Carr was volatile. She inspired a character in the novel, a radio host named Madame Psychosis who ends up in the halfway house. Wallace got a tattoo of a heart with Mary's name on it. He signed his letters to her, Young Werfer. He proposed to her. They fought. Someone you get sober with is like someone you were in Vietnam with, Carr remembers. They split up. One day, according to Carr, he broke her coffee table. She billed him $100. He paid her and said that the remains of the table were now his. Carr told him that she'd used them for firewood and that all he'd bought was the brokenness. In spring of 1993, Wallace submitted the first two-thirds of Infinite Jest, some 400,000 words. Page, who had edited Rick Moody and Mark Lehner, had no trouble understanding Wallace's aesthetic. He wrote Wallace, "It's a novel made up out of shards, almost as if the story were something broken that someone is picking up the pieces of." He warned Wallace that at this rate, the finished book would likely top 1,200 pages. That same spring, Wallace accepted a teaching job at Illinois State University in Normal, which had just started a Center for Contemporary Literature. In Illinois, with much of Infinite Jest written, he began to settle down. He bought a house, the first he'd owned, on the outskirts of Bloomington, a town that adjoined Normal. He was happy to be back in the Midwest. He got his first dog, Jeeves, at the pound, and began to work at home. He chose a room to write in and painted it black, and then filled it with dozens of vintage lamps. He preferred the company of townspeople to academics, and he made a point of being available to his students, especially those in the midst of personal crises. He told most people that he did not use email, but he gave his students an address. Sections of Infinite Jest began to appear in magazines, but he downplayed his growing fame as a writer. Doug Hess, a colleague, made the mistake of praising an essay of Wallace's. "He did this gesture of wiping the butt with one hand and pointing to his mouth with the other," Hess remembers. "I learned really, really quickly not to go beyond the equivalent of, how's the weather?" In Bloomington, Wallace struggled with the size of his book. He hit upon the idea of endnotes to shorten it. In April 1994, he presented the idea to Peach, adding, "I've become intensely attached to this strategy and will fight with all 20 claws to preserve it." He explained that endnotes allow me to make the primary text an easier read while at once, one, allowing a discursive, authorial, intrusive style without Finneganizing it, the story. Two, mimic the information flood and data triage I'd expected would be an even bigger part of U.S. life 15 years hence. Three, have a lot more technical medical verisimilitude. Four, allow make the reader go literally, physically back and forth in a way that perhaps cutely mimics some of the story's thematic concerns. Five, feel emotionally like I'm satisfying your request for compression of text without sacrificing enormous amounts of stuff. He also said, "I pray this is nothing like hypertext, but it seems to be interesting and the best way to get the exfoliating curve line plot I wanted." Peach countered with an offer of footnotes, which readers would find less cumbersome, but eventually agreed. Though Infinite Jest had begun as a book with Hal Incandenza at its center, as it grew, Wallace moved his focus more to the figure of Don Gately, a former Demerol addict and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who is now a supervisor at a halfway house down the hill from the tennis academy where Hal plays. Gately, who as a child was nicknamed B.I.M. for Big Industrial Moron, is a tender thug. Late in the book, Quebecois separatists shoot him in the shoulder while he is trying to protect his charges, and many of the novel's final 100 pages depict Gately's thoughts as he lies immobilized in his hospital bed, going over his life in his mind. Because he refuses to take narcotic painkillers, Gately is in agony, but he learns a way to get inside his suffering. He could do the dextral pain, he thinks. No. No single instant of it was unendurable. He hadn't quite gotten this before now, how it wasn't just a matter of writing out the cravings for a substance. Everything unendurable was in the head. Was the head not abiding in the present, but hopping the wall and doing a recon and then returning with unendurable news? Gately is the first character whose distress seems to touch Wallace. He wrote Gately's reverie quickly. He even sent Jeeves away so that he could work without interruptions. Talking to Costello, he said that his work was going so well that, quote, he couldn't feel my ass in the chair, end quote. Infinite Jest ends with Gately in a haze, imagining a peaceful end, possibly his death. Quote, and when he came back to, he was flat on his back on the beach in the freezing sand, and it was raining out of a low sky, and the tide was way out, end quote. Wallace sent the remaining 600 pages of the manuscript to Pitch in the summer of 1994. Pitch had not expected Gately to assume such a dominant role. The ending of the novel, The Horror of Gately's Hitting Bottom, is gorgeous and very, very powerfully sad, he wrote Wallace in December. He expressed concern, however, over the novel's many dangling threads. Earlier, he had cautioned Wallace that the reader, after so many pages, would feel entitled to find out who or how or why. Wallace was more certain of his literary approach than he had been when he published Broom. He knew what he wanted to resolve and what not. He wrote to Peach, "We know exactly what's happening to Gately by the end, about 50% of what's happened to Hal, and little but hints about Oren. I can give you 5,000 words of theoretico-structural argument for this, but let's spare one another, shall we?" Peach suggested extensive cuts, many of which Wallace accepted. Eventually, he learned to erase passages that he liked from his hard drive in order to keep himself from putting them back in. In all, he delivered 1,700 pages, of which Peach cut several hundred. The bound galleys went out with a list of corrections that hadn't made the printer's deadline. Infinite Jest, published in February 1996, quickly became a totem for young people. The postmodernist heyday was long past. Minimalism was in decline. There was a wide opening for Wallace's opaque sincerity. His, quote, impulse to second-guess every thought and proposition became something like a generational style, as Gerald Howard said. One day, Howard was walking down West Broadway in Manhattan and came across a line of people waiting to hear Wallace read at Rizzoli. There was this adoration, he remembers. He had reached people in this highly personal way. Wallace did not like being the object of so much attention. He wrote to Don DeLillo, with whom he had begun a correspondence, that he had, quote, tried my best to tell the truth and to be kind to reporters who hadn't read the book and wanted only to discuss the hype around the book and seemed willfully to ignore the fact that articles about the hype were themselves the hype. For about a week there, it seemed to me that the book became the most photographed barn, everyone tremendously excited over the tremendous excitement surrounding a book that takes over a month of hard labor to read, end quote. As soon as he could, he finished his book tour and retreated to Bloomington, to his house, and to Jeeves and the drone, a stray who had joined him and Jeeves one day when they were out running. In the wake of Infinite Jest, he felt anxiety about his writing. Earlier, Wallace had asked DeLillo whether it was normal. DeLillo reassured him, invoking Henry James' word, "Doubt is our passion." And he added, some writers may have to do 2-3 books, say in mid-career, before they remember that writing can be fun. Wallace worked successfully on some stories, later published in 2004 collection Oblivion. In The Soul Is Not a Smithy, a man looking back on his childhood wonders how his father could have endured the boredom of his work as an actuary. The truth is, I have no idea what he thought about, what his internal life might have been, the son acknowledges. Wallace also began to develop a taste for journalism. he could transmit in a more straightforward way his point that America was at once over-entertained and sad. He took a trip on a cruise ship out of Florida to sample the packaged hedonism and chronicled the casual cruelty of the Maine lobster fare. "Is it all right to boil a sentient creature alive just for our gustatory pleasure?" he asked. Yet he felt unfulfilled. When Charlie Rose interviewed him in 1997, Wallace said, "A lot of my problem right now is I don't really have a brass ring, and I'm kind of open to suggestions about what one chases." He wrote to DeLillo that he thought he knew what was missing to get his fiction moving forward. "I believe I want adult sanity, which seems to me the only unalloyed form of heroism available today." The Pale King, the name Wallace gave to the novel that, had he finished it, would have been his third, was one-third complete by an estimate that he had made to Nadell in 2007. The novel continues Wallace's preoccupation with mindfulness. It is about being in the moment and paying attention to the things that matter and centers on a group of several dozen IRS agents working in the Midwest. Their job is tedious, but dullness, the Pale King suggests, ultimately sets them free. A typed note that Wallace left in his papers laid out the novel's idea. Quote, "Bliss, a second-by-second joy and gratitude at the gift of being alive, conscious, lies on the other side of crushing, crushing boredom. Pay close attention to the most tedious things you can find, tax returns, televised golf, and in waves of boredom like you'll never have known before will wash over you and just about kill you. Ride these out, and it's like stepping from black and white into color, like water after days in the desert, instant bliss in every atom." On another draft sheet, Wallace typed a possible epigraph for the book from Borges and I, a prose poem by Frank Bidart. Quote, "We fill pre-existing forms, and when we fill them, we change them and are changed," end quote. The problem was how to dramatize the idea. As Michael Pitch points out, in choosing the IRS as a subject, Wallace had, quote, "posed himself the task that is almost the opposite of how fiction works, which is leaving out the things that are not of much interest," end quote. Wallace's solution was to overwhelm his seemingly inert subject with the full movement of his thought. His characters might be low-level bureaucrats, but the robust sincerity of his writing, his willingness to die for the reader, would keep you from condescending to them. In one chapter, Wallace narrates the spiritual awakening of a college student named Chris Fogel as follows. "I was by myself, wearing nylon warm-up pants and a black Pink Floyd t-shirt, trying to spin a soccer ball on my finger and watching the CBS soap opera As the World Turns on the room's little black and white zenith. There was certainly always reading and studying for finals I could do, but I was being a wastoid. Anyway, I was sitting there trying to spin the ball on my finger and watching the soap opera. And at the end of every commercial break, the show's trademark shot of planet Earth as seen from space, turning, would appear, and the CBS daytime network announcer's voice would say, 'You're watching As the World Turns,' which he seemed, on this particular day, to say more and more pointedly each time, 'You're watching As the World Turns,' until the tone began to seem almost incredulous. 'You're watching As the World Turns?' Until I was suddenly struck by the bare reality of the statement. It was as if the CBS announcer was speaking directly to me, shaking my shoulder or leg as though trying to arouse someone from sleep. 'You're watching As the World Turns.' I didn't stand for anything. If I wanted to matter, even just to myself, I would have to be less free by deciding to choose in some kind of a definite way." Fogel decides to join the IRS and soon heads off for training in Peoria. He finds that the sustained attentiveness demanded by tax work is not easy to muster. One of Foley's colleagues, Lane Dean Jr., finds it especially difficult to push away the outside world. As he processes forms, Dean tries to visualize a sunny beach, as the agency taught him to do during orientation. But he cannot maintain the image. It turns in his mind to a gray expanse covered with, quote, dead kelp like the hair of the drowned, end quote. Overcome with boredom, he entertains suicide as a possibility. He had the sensation of a great typer of hole or emptiness falling through him and continuing to fall and never hitting the floor, Wallace writes. Other agents are adepts. An agent named Mitchell Drinion is so centered and calm that he levitates as he works. Drinion is happy, Wallace wrote in one of the notebooks he kept while writing The Pale King. Another agent can recite a sequence of numbers that takes him into a state of exalted concentration. There is also an anxious young agent who sweated uncontrollably in high school, racing to the bathroom where, quote, the toilet paper dentist disintegrates into little greebles and blobs all over his forehead, end quote. He is afraid of thinking about being afraid, lest he suddenly become afraid and break out in a sweat, the victim of a, quote, an endless funhouse hall of mirrors of fear, end quote. In the quiet study of tax forms, he seeks composure. The Pale King does not abandon postmodernism entirely. The novel is structured as a mock memoir. In a chapter called Author's Foreword, Wallace informs the reader that he was once an employee at the IRS. Upon entering the bureaucracy, he reveals agents are given new Social Security numbers. Taking a job there is like being born again. The conceit is pure fiction. In the mid-1980s, Wallace announces he became, quote, 947042012, end quote. After being caught selling term papers and suspended from his preppy college, he cast around for something to do and applied to work at the IRS. The agency hired him as a wiggler, the first people to go over returns arriving at the agency. I arrived for intake processing at Lake James, Illinois' IRS Post 047, sometime in mid-May of 1985, Wallace writes. A digression follows, a long footnote on the history of Lake James, followed by commentary about the confusion of having an IRS office whose mailing address and building address are in separate towns. Upon arriving at the intake center, Wallace says he was given special treatment after being mistaken for another David Wallace, a high-powered accountant, transferring to the facility from Rome, New York. For much of the chapter, everyone at the IRS thinks that David Foster Wallace is the other Wallace, giving the author a double to go with his fictional rebirth. On his undeserved VIP tour, Wallace gets a glimpse of a different world. A calmer one, with a, quote, silence, both sensuous and incongruous. His chatty guide, Miss Nettie Nettie, accidentally opens the wrong door, showing him the room where agents do their silent work. Wallace portrays it as a kind of monastery. Quote, I caught a glimpse of a long room filled with IRS examiners in long rows and columns of strange-looking tables or desks. Each of them had a raised array of trays or baskets clamped to its top, with flexible-necked desk lamps in turn clamped at angles to these fanned-out arrays, so that each of the IRS examiners worked in a small, tight circle of light, row after row, stretching to a kind of vanishing point near the room's rear wall. Wallace's unquiet mind is not yet ready for this paradise. Miss Nettie Nettie quickly spirits him away. Wallace began the research for The Pale King shortly after the publication of Infinite Jest. He took accounting classes. He studied IRS publications. You should have seen him with our accountant, Karen Green remembers. It was like, what about the ruling of 920S? He enjoyed mastering the technicalities of the IRS bureaucracy, its lore, mindset, vocabulary. He assembled hundreds of pages of research on boredom, trying to understand it at an almost neurological level. He studied the word's etymology and was intrigued to find that boar appeared in the language in 1766, 2 years before interesting came to mean absorbing. He put this revelation into the mouth of the ghost of an IRS agent who comforts Lane Dean Jr. when he despairs. Wallace began writing The Pale King around 2000. A severe critic of his own work, he rarely reported to his friends that anything he was working on was going well. But his complaints about this book struck them as particularly intense. Peach remembers being on a car ride with Wallace and hearing him compare writing the novel to, quote, trying to carry a sheet of plywood in a windstorm, end quote. On another occasion, Wallace told him that he had completed, quote, 200 pages, of which maybe 40 are usable, end quote. He had created some good characters, but the shape of the book evaded him. In 2004, he wrote to Jonathan Franzen that to get the book done, he would have to write a 5,000-page manuscript and then winnow it by 90%, the very idea of which makes something in me wither and get really interested in my cuticle or the angle of the light outside. Wallace's literary frustrations contrasted with his growing personal happiness. In 2002, he began dating Karen Green, a visual artist. She had asked him for permission to turn his story, The Depressed Person, into a series of illustrated panels. The depressed person was in terrible and unceasing emotional pain, the story begins, and the impossibility of sharing or articulating this pain was itself a component of the pain and a contributing factor in its essential horror. Through the course of The Depressed Person, the unlovable, self-absorbed girl shuttles between friends and therapist, looking for a sympathetic ear. Only with real human contact can she improve. Wallace's story ends without a resolution. Green wanted to rewrite Wallace so that in her last panel, the depressed person would be cured. Wallace gave her permission. When he saw what she had done, he was happy. He told her it was now a story that people would want to read. They fell in love. Wallace put a strikeout through Mary's name on his tattoo and an asterisk under the heart. Farther down, he added another asterisk and Karen's name, turning his arm into a living footnote. In 2004, Wallace and Green were married in Urbana in front of his parents. Wallace had by then accepted a new teaching appointment at Pomona College in Claremont, California. "I have a lottery prize type gig at Pomona," he bragged to the new believer in 2003. "I get to do more or less what I want." Green chose a ranch-style house for them in Claremont. Wallace took his large collection of lamps and books on accounting into the garage and started writing. He did not always stay in his workplace. Green remembers that on days when he was struggling, he would go from the garage to the guest room, where there was an extra computer, and onto the family room to write in longhand with his earplugs in, quote, scattering debris, intellectual and otherwise, end quote. Green had a son, a teenager named Sterling, from a previous marriage, and he sometimes visited. Wallace, who never felt that he was cut out to be a father, bonded with the boy. They played chess together, with Sterling usually winning. Wallace was growing tired of teaching, but he continued to enjoy the contact with students. One student, Kelly Natoli, remembers Wallace introducing himself on the first day of creative writing class. He said, "It's going to take me like 2 weeks to learn everyone's name, but by the time I learn your name, I'm going to remember your name for the rest of my life. You're going to forget who I am before I forget who you are." Wallace was thrilled that his personal life was in order. He took it as evidence that he had matured. He teased Green about what a good husband he was, and she remembers him saying, "I took out the garbage, did you see that? And I put tea on for you when you were driving home." Green was a good partner for Wallace, too. Supportive and literate, but not in awe of her husband. "We used to have this joke about how much you can irritate the reader," Green recalls. He could be needy. At night, he would beg her not to get sick or die. At Pomona, Wallace published Oblivion. The last story is about a man for whom great art comes so easily he can defecate it. He also wrote essays, published his book on infinity, and went to Wimbledon to write about Roger Federer for the Times. To DeLillo, he wrote, "I do not know why the comparative ease and pleasure of writing nonfiction always concerns my intuition that fiction is really what I'm supposed to do. But it does. And now I'm back here flogging away, in all senses of the word, and feeding my own wastebasket." The Pale King had many ambitions. It would show people a way to insulate themselves from the toxic freneticism of American life. It had to be emotionally engaged and morally sound, and to narrate boredom while obeying the physics of reading. And it had to put over the point that the kind of personality that conferred grace was exactly the kind that Wallace did not have. In 2005, Wallace wrote in his notebook, "They're rare, but they're among us. People able to achieve and sustain a certain steady state of concentration, attention, despite what they're doing." It did not escape him that his failing to write the book was rising to the meta level, that he could not write it because he could not himself ignore the noise of modern life. Wallace made a considerable start, though. He found a style that was amusing and engaging, that captured mindfulness without solemnity. Perhaps someone else reading the novel, Wallace would show it to no one, might have been satisfied. But his own past brilliance stalked him. In his author's foreword, he assures the reader, "The very last thing this book is some kind of clever metafictional titty pincher." He also writes, "I find these sorts of cute, self-referential paradoxes irksome too. At least now that I'm over 30, I do." And yet, there he was, writing about David Wallace in long, recursive sentences with footnotes. The Pale King slowly came into being. In one of Wallace's notebooks, there is a sentence suggesting that he had hit on the framework of a plot. An evil group within the IRS is trying to steal the secrets of an agent who is particularly gifted at maintaining a heightened state of concentration. It was a witty notion, an echo of the Quebecois villains in Infinite Jest. It is not clear that Wallace followed up on it, but if he did, it did not satisfy him. "The individual parts of this book would not be all that hard to read," he wrote Bonnie Nadell in 2007. "It's more the juxtaposition of them, the number of separate characters, etc." At times, Wallace put The Pale King aside and then picked it up again. He polished the sentences over and over. A few sections achieved what he was aiming for or came close. In 2007, he published in this magazine a small part of the novel, which dealt with Lane Dean Jr.'s early decision to have a baby with a woman he was dating. A picture of the infant on his desk comforts Dean when he considers suicide. Another scene in which an IRS agent's calm is disturbed by a colleague's menacing baby found its way into Harper's as the compliance branch. Wallace was aware that he did not have to keep working on The Pale King. He had become a vocal critic of the Bush administration. "I am at present partisan," he told The Believer in 2003. "Worse than that, I feel such deep, visceral antipathy that I can't seem to think or speak or write in any kind of fair or nuanced way about the current administration. My own plan for the coming 14 months is to knock on doors and stuff envelopes, maybe even to wear a button, to try to accrete with others into a demographically significant mass, to try extra hard to exercise patience, politeness, and imagination on those with whom I disagree. Also to floss more." Green in an email told me that, quote, "mostly what we did was rant and give dollars, rant and give dollars." Wallace and Green discussed his quitting writing. He talked openly about opening up a dog shelter, she remembers. "Who knows," he wrote to Franzen about the idea. "Life sure is short, though." He considered focusing on his nonfiction. The Federer piece had brought him joy. He stopped the nonfiction for a period to see if it made the fiction come easier. Was the magazine work dissipating his ability to finish The Pale King? It just made him crazy to think he had been working on it for so long, Green remembers. Wallace tried to keep things in perspective. In July 2005, he wrote an email to Franson. Karen is killing herself rehabbing the house. I sit in the garage with the AC blasting and work very poorly and haltingly and with, some days, great reluctance and ambivalence and pain. I am tired of myself, it seems. Tired of my thoughts, associations, syntax, various verbal habits that have gone from discovery to technique to tick. It's a dark time work-wise, and yet a very light and lovely time in all other respects. So overall, I feel I'm ahead and pretty happy. 6 months later, in another email to Franson, he spoke of, quote, many, many pages written, then either tossed or put in a sealed box, end quote. He wrote, the whole thing is a tornado that won't hold still long enough for me to see what's useful and what isn't. Adding, I brooded and brooded about all this till my brooder is sore. Maybe the answer is simply to do what I want to do would take more effort than I am willing to put in. Which would be a bleak reality indeed, if that's all it is. In the same note, he says how much he admired Philip Roth, who was enjoying, as he saw it, a Dostoevskian golden period. In his major final interview, given to Le Nouvel Observateur in August 2007, he talked about various writers he admired, St. Paul, Rousseau, Dostoevsky, among them, and added, what are envied and coveted here seem to me to be the qualities of human beings, capacities of spirit, rather than technical abilities or special talents. He was no longer sure he was the kind of person who could write the novel he wanted to write. Around this time, Wallace wrote Nadell telling her that he needed to put some kind of duress slash pressure on myself so I quit futzing around, changing my mind about the book twice a week and just actually do it. He prepared a stack of about 150 pages of Pale King to send to Peach. There were plenty of equally finished pages, among them the story of the levitating Drinion, which, for whatever reason, he did not include. I could take a couple of years of unpaid leave from Pomona and try and finish it, he wrote to Nadell. When she encouraged him, he responded more hesitantly. Let me noodle hard about it. It may not be until the end of the summer that I'd even have a packet together. In June, he emailed Franson. I go back and forth between A, working to assemble a big enough sample to take an advance, and B, recoiling in despair, thinking I'd pitch everything and start over. Meanwhile, Wallace was becoming more convinced that Nardil might be getting in the way of the Pale King. The distorting effect of being on antidepressants was something that had long bothered him. In the planet Trilophon, the story he wrote while at Amherst, his character says, I've been on antidepressants for, what, about a year now? And I suppose I feel as if I'm pretty qualified to tell what they're like. They're fine, really. But they're fine in the same way that, say, living on another planet that was warm and comfortable and had food and fresh water would be fine. It would be fine, but it wouldn't be good old Earth. There were other important reasons to get off Nardil. The drug could create problems with his blood pressure and increasing worry as he moved into middle age. In the spring of 2007, when he went to the Persian restaurant and left with severe stomach pains, the doctor told him that Nardil might have interacted badly with his meal and added that there were better options now. Nardil was, quote, a dirty drug, end quote. Wallace saw an opportunity. He told Green that he wanted to try a different antidepressant. You know what? I'm up for it, she remembers answering. She knew that the decision was hard for him. The person who would go off the medications that were possibly keeping him alive was not the person he liked, she says. He didn't want to care about the writing as much as he did. Soon after, he stopped the drug. At first, he felt that the process was going well. I feel a bit peculiar, which is the only way to describe it, he emailed Franson in August. All this is to be expected, 22 years in all, and I'm not unduly alarmed. A month later, he was more concerned. I've been blowing stuff off and then having it slip my mind. This is the harshest place of the washout process so far. It's a bit like I imagine a course of chemo would be. He remained fairly confident it will pass in time. 3 months later, he wrote to Nadell, "Upside, I've lost 30 pounds. Downside, I haven't even thought about work since like September. I'm figuring I get 90 more days before I even remotely expect anything of myself." The shrink expert says that that's a fairly sane attitude. Ever since he ended his addictions, drugs have been anathema to Wallace. Don Gately's refusal to take narcotic painkillers after he is shot makes him the hero of Infinite Jest. At one point after getting off Nardil, Wallace decided he should try to do without any antidepressant. Given his psychiatric history, Green was worried. Her husband, she remembers thinking, would need a Jungian miracle. In the fall, Wallace had to be hospitalized for severe depression. When he came out, doctors prescribed other antidepressants. But according to Green, he was now too panicked to give them time to work. He took over the job of keeping himself sane, second-guessing doctors and their prescriptions. If he tried a new drug, he would read that a possible side effect was anxiety, and that alone would make him too anxious to stay on the drug. He was in a hall of mirrors of fear. He continued to write in a notebook, but he rarely returned to his massive manuscript. The Pale King had once referred to the IRS, or possibly to the state of contentment and focus the book advocated. But now, as he wrote in a notebook, it was a synonym for the depression that tormented him. Not every day was bad. He taught. He emailed friends. He and Green tried to maintain their lives. Always self-critical, Wallace would rate good days as B+ or cautiously optimistic. They joked about the unthinkable. Green warned him that if he killed himself, she'd be, quote, "the Yoko Ono of the literary world, the woman with all the hair who domesticated you, and look what happened." They made a pact that he would not make her guess how he was doing. During the spring of 2008, a new combination of antidepressants seemed to stabilize him. When GQ asked him to write an essay on Obama and rhetoric, he felt almost well enough to do it. The magazine reserved a hotel room for him in Denver, but he canceled. That June, the annual booksellers convention was in Los Angeles, and Wallace drove there to have dinner with Peach, Nadell, and a few others. Peach was amazed at how thin Wallace was. Nadell, at Wallace's request, explained to magazine editors that he had a stomach malady. "It had to be severe enough to explain why he couldn't travel," she remembers. About 10 days after the dinner, Wallace checked into a motel about 10 miles from his home and took an overdose of pills. When he woke up, he called Green, who had been searching for him all night. When she met him at the hospital, he told her that he was glad to be alive. He was sorry that he'd made her look for him. He switched doctors and agreed to try electroconvulsive therapy again. He was terrified at the prospect. In Urbana, it had temporarily taken away his short-term memory, but he underwent 12 sessions. They did not help. Caring for Wallace was exhausting. For 1 9-day period, Green never left their house. In August, her son suffered an athletic injury, and she wanted to be with him. Wallace's parents came to look after David. "It's like they're throwing darts at a dartboard," he complained to them about his doctors. They went with him to an appointment with a psychiatrist when the doctor suggested a new drug combination. Wallace rolled his eyes. Eventually, Wallace asked to go back on Nardil, but Nardil can take weeks to stabilize a patient, and Green says that he was too agitated to give it time to work. Still, in early September, Nadell spoke with him and thought that he sounded a bit better. Green believes that she knows when Wallace decided to try to kill himself. She says of September 6th, "That Saturday was a really good day. Monday and Tuesday were not so good. He started lying to me that Wednesday." He waited 2 days for an opportunity. In the early evening on Friday, September 12th, Green went to prepare for an opening at her art gallery, Beautiful Crap, in the center of Claremont, about 10 minutes from their home. She felt comforted by the fact that he'd seen the chiropractor on Monday. "You don't go to the chiropractor if you're going to commit suicide," she says. After she left, Wallace went into the garage and turned on the lights. He wrote her a 2-page note. Then he crossed through the house to the patio, where he climbed onto a chair and hanged himself. When one character dies in infinite jest, he is, quote, catapulted home over, glass palisades at desperate speed, soaring north, sounding a bell clear and nearly maternal alarmed call to arms in all the world's well-known tongues. Green returned home at 9:30 and found her husband. In the garage, bathed in light from his many lamps, sat a pile of nearly 200 pages. He had made some changes in the months since he'd considered sending them to Little Brown. The story of David Wallace was now first. In his final hours, he had tidied up the manuscript so that his wife could find it. Below it, around it, inside his two computers, on old floppy disks in his drawers were hundreds of other pages. Drafts, character sketches, notes to himself, fragments that had evaded his attempt to integrate them into the world. This was his effort to show the world what it was to be a effing human being. He had not completed it to his satisfaction. This was not an ending anyone would have wanted for him. But it was the ending he chose. We'll finish today with an essay in the Talk of the Town section, Daily Comment, from the August 15th, 2018 edition of The New Yorker. The essay is entitled Trump and the Enemies of the People by David Remnick. Nikita Khrushchev, in his memoirs, observed that Joseph Stalin, his despotic and bloody-minded predecessor, referred to everyone who didn't agree with him as an enemy of the people. As a result, several hundred thousand honest people perished, Khrushchev said, underestimating the number of dead from Stalin's mass repressions by many millions. Quote, everyone lived in fear in those days. Everyone expected that at any moment there would be a knock on the door in the middle of the night, and that knock on the door would prove fatal. Countless men and women, artists, journalists, farmers, intellectuals, engineers, scientists, were shot in the back of the head or banished to the vast system of labor camps that Alexander Solzhenitsyn described in the Gulag Archipelago. As a military and communist leader, Khrushchev himself had played a role in that butchery. He had dutifully signed arrest records. He turned a blind eye to the executions of innumerable party comrades. And yet, in 1956, 3 years after Stalin's death, he bravely delivered a secret speech to the Communist Party's Central Committee in which he repudiated Stalin's cult of personality. He described in shocking terms how the term enemies of the people had been an instrument of the physical annihilation of so many human beings now buried in frozen earth from Murmansk to Magadan. Khrushchev's thaw, his project of de-Stalinization, quickly met with firm resistance from within the party. He barely survived a coup attempt in 1957, and he was finally ousted in 1964. The manuscript of his memoirs had to be smuggled to the West. It finally ended up in the hands of editors at Little Brown and Company and Life magazine. But in that fleeting period of liberalization, a new generation came to maturity. A very small number of men and women became dissidents, incurring tremendous risks as they typed up forbidden manuscripts, spoke out against the crushing of the Prague Spring in 1968, and protested other acts of violence against human rights and dignity. Many more became the so-called shetadastaniki, men and women who came of age in the 60s and who worked within the system, making myriad compromises of the spirit, all the while searching for openings to change Soviet society. Their great chance came in 1985 with the ascension of Mikhail Gorbachev. Gorbachev's crucial insight, his ideological foes would call it his ruinous insight, was that the Soviet Union, for all its success as a nuclear military power, was otherwise frozen in time, economically and technologically backward. Upper Volta with rockets was how the joke went. Without an honest reckoning with history, without truthful reporting on contemporary realities, without intellectual freedom, the Soviet Union would fall deeper into a state of isolation and torpor. And so Gorbachev initiated a policy known as glasnost, or openness. That meant the publication of forbidden authors, Akhmatova, Mandelstam, Solzhenitsyn, Bulgakov, Brodsky. Historians began to scrutinize not only Stalin, but also Lenin, the regime's founding father and ideological deity. Foreign writers who had been previously considered threats to the Soviet security, Orwell, Huxley, Havel, were published. And perhaps most essential to the political moment, Gorbachev and his liberal allies in the leadership sanctioned the editors of the Moscow News on Konyuk and other publications to print articles on corruption, poverty, the war in Afghanistan, homosexuality, a range of subjects that had not been previously made their way past censors. By casting the press as an enemy, Trump is not merely joining a long list of presidents who have bristled at criticism. He goes much further than his predecessors, including paranoiacs like Richard Nixon, who assembled a secret enemies list and raged in the Oval Office to his chief of staff about barring the Washington Post from White House grounds. Trump's rages are public. They are daily, and they are part of a concerted effort to undermine precepts of American constitutionalism and to cast his lot with the illiberal and authoritarian movements now on the rise around the world. Well, sounds like we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you've enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast and all previous New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.